Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum. Celebrate the opening of I Saw It, Francisco de Goya Printmaker, with an evening of live music, art making, live model drawing, tours, and more. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. Info at nortonsimon.org.
What we learned investigating the death of Chicano student activist Oscar Gomez.
It sounds like you ran almost every theory to its end.
Binge all 8 episodes of Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. You're listening to music from the original soundtrack of the animated Disney film Mulan. This week, it's Disney's live-action version, directed by Nicky Caro. We'll hear what our critics think about that, as well as Charlie Kaufman's new movie. The writer-director turns to the horror genre in I'm Thinking of Ending Things. We also have a number of documentaries, including Jimmy Carter, Rock and Roll President, which shows how central rock music performers were to Jimmy Carter's candidacy, and Feels Good Man, a documentary about the animated character Pepe the Frog. Those and more films to be reviewed on Film Week, coming up right after NPR News.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting an evening in focus, Goya. The museum's galleries come to life at this interactive event, celebrating the opening of the exhibition, I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. Enjoy live music, art-making activities for all ages, live model drawing, tours, and more. Free with museum admission. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us, whether you're listening on the podcast, from wherever you get your podcast, you're here at 89.3 KPCC or the KPCC app. I'm joined this week by film critics Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com, and Angie Hahn, who's film critic for Mashable, where she's also the publication's deputy entertainment editor. We begin with the long-awaited Disney live-action version of Mulan. The film was directed by Nick Caro and written by 4 credited writers. Angie, please start us on Mulan.
Yeah, so obviously, like you said, this is a live-action remake of the 1998 Disney animated classic, which itself was an adaptation of an old Chinese legend. And what I like about this one is that, unlike a lot of other Disney live-action remakes we've seen, like Beauty and the Beast and Lion King, it's not a shot-for-shot, beat-by-beat remake of the animated original. It's really retelling the story from the ground up with a totally different style and tone. And I also appreciated how good it looks. Like, the landscapes are stunning, the props and the costumes are exquisite, the action takes inspiration from Wuxia, which gives it a totally different feel and from most Disney action movies. Everything you're looking at looks good, but I've seen this film twice. I saw it on the big screen at the premiere and then again on my TV at home a few days ago, and unfortunately this is a movie that really feels like it was made for the big screen. Like, you really need that big screen to feel the scope and the energy of it and to pick up on some of the subtler choices it's making. So things that played as a little bit subtle on the big screen, like the lead performance seems a little too muted on the small screen, and she ends up seeming like too generically brave and noble of a hero. So without that, Mulan feels very epic and grand, but also like it's just trying too hard to be respectful and kind of missing a little bit of the personality. It feels a little bit staid. So overall, my impression from the second time is this is a very pretty remake of Mulan with some great action that makes some interesting updates to the story, but it's a little too grown up for kids and not complex enough for actual grown ups. I appreciate what it's trying to do, but I don't think it's going to replace the original in the affections of many Disney fans.
I so wonder, Angie, if once we're through the pandemic, that Disney will release this to be seen on a big screen as it was intended for the film. If they think there'll be demand after people have been able to watch it on Disney Plus weeks on end. What do you think, Tim, about this live action version of Mulan?
Well, I will agree that all that color and those set pieces do scream for scale, for a big old screen, absolutely. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is a father-daughter story, and I'm a sucker for a father-daughter story. And The Legend of Mulan, our heroine, will take her father's place in the Emperor's army. Many evil forces will array against her, but she will rise. And I got to tell you, that emotional story gets me every time. I only saw this movie once. I saw that animation in 1998, 22 years ago. And watching it with my goddaughter, who was, six or seven, 22 years ago, and wore out a couple of VHS tapes, she pointed out to me everything that had been changed. She remembered all of it. Our Wade Major tells me that his very young daughter also could point out everything that had been changed. Didn't bother them all that terribly much. Some of the stuff that has been changed, there are no songs per se. But we do get the lyrics of those songs. We get the lyrics of those songs spoken as dialogue in the scenes where the songs would have been previously. You know, we get a good deal of Harry Gregson-Williams' score, too. They refer to it all the time, he and Matthew Zippel. But, you know, without those songs and that exact score, and when these lyrics are spoken, they become kind of ponderous. And I don't know, you can sort of feel the weight of it all. It's almost like it's out of sync or something, but it's not. But when it's not explaining something, when it's not issuing orders, when people aren't casting spells, when it's quiet, when it's action, well, then that's the Mulan that I remember from that cartoon. And I like that movie pretty much.
Mulan is available on Disney Plus, but with the caveat, it's $30 in addition to your monthly subscription. So it is expensive, probably going to be seeing this with, you know, whatever safe groups can gather, if people can, to see it safely. Mulan, the live action version, is rated PG-13. Well, Tenet is not being screened in Southern California theaters because, obviously, movie theaters here are closed. So the closest place you can see the new film from writer-director Christopher Nolan is Las Vegas. Later on Film Week, John Horn will be with us. He went to Vegas to see it in a movie theater there. But theaters in Europe have been open for some time, so we asked Berlin-based film critic Jessica Kyung, who writes for Variety and the online publication The Playlist, we asked her to provide this guest review of Tenet.
Full disclosure, I am reviewing Tenet for you all the way from Europe, where the reopening of movie theaters has been going on for quite a bit longer than in the States, which is to say, please do not take anything I'm about to say as an endorsement of going to the movie theater in your area unless you have checked in advance that they are taking enough precautions to ensure your safety. But say you have made those inquiries and you are satisfied and you're going to go to the cinema this weekend, should you go to see Christopher Nolan's Tenet? In that case, especially given the less than stellar other options on offer at your multiplex, my answer would probably be a pretty unqualified yes. Not because Tenet is a masterpiece, but it does have one element that is especially crucial if, as I think will often be the case, it's your first film on the big screen in a while. And that is scale. This movie is enormous, sometimes even to its detriment. There are moments when the rumbling sound design and Ludwig Göransson's sonic boom of a score and the fact that everyone's on a catamaran for some reason makes it actually very difficult to hear the dialogue. That would probably be more of an issue if the dialogue we did hear made any sense, and it really doesn't. Tenet follows a CIA agent, played by John David Washington, down and kind of up a time-bending rabbit hole where he stumbles upon a process called inversion. This is where an object, say a bullet or a car or even a person, can have its entropy reversed, which makes it appear to be moving backward in time while everything else is still going forward. Now, you don't have to have a master's in physics, which is what Robert Pattinson's sidekick character has in this movie, to know that this is kind of nonsense and makes absolutely no scientific sense. But all you do really need to know is that it gives Christopher Nolan the opportunity for some incredibly intricate and exciting set pieces in which some elements are spooling forward in time and others are going backward. There's even a fight between two characters when one of them is inverted and the other isn't, and it kind of makes your brain explode in a good way. Tenet, the word, is a palindrome, and the film has a roughly palindromic structure. So there's a pivot scene in the middle, after which we begin to revisit some of the scenes we've already been through, this time from a different perspective, all in the name of thwarting the villainous baddie played by Kenneth Branagh, who is so villainous that he's even mean to his gorgeous wife, Elizabeth Debicki, who, as is unfortunately normal for women in Christopher Nolan screenplays, does not have much of a character to play. Christopher Nolan is well known as the creator of so-called brainy blockbusters like Inception and Interstellar, and on one level, Tenet is that, but it's also the kind of brainy that really doesn't have much application in the real world, except maybe if you're a Sudoku fan. So I'd say follow the advice given by a scientist character in the movie, played by Clémence Poésy, and she says, don't try to understand it, feel it. So go to Tenet if you like solving puzzles. Go if you want to see a very charismatic John David Washington and a very charming Robert Pattinson spark up a bromance that is maybe the closest thing that Christopher Nolan has ever got to actual romance. But most importantly, only go if you know you're going to be safe.
That's our guest critic for today, Jessica Kiang, joining us from Venice, Italy, where she's covering the Venice Film Festival. She writes for Variety and the online publication The Playlist. You can also find Jessica's full review of Tenet in the New York Times. Tenet is rated PG-13. Not available for viewing in Southern California. But again, if you're really hot to see the film, you could go to Vegas, see it in a theater there where theaters are open. Later this hour, our John Horn did just that, went to Las Vegas, and will share his experience of watching Tenet in a movie theater. He also interviews the star of Tenet, John David Washington. You'll hear that later on Film Week on KPCC. We continue with Angie and Tim and their reviews of the latest film from writer-director Charlie Kaufman, I'm Thinking of Ending Things. Jesse Buckley and Jesse Plemons star, along with Toni Collette and David Thewlis. It's a Netflix horror drama. Angie, what do you think of I'm Thinking of Ending Things?
I really liked it a lot, but I am a big fan of Charlie Kaufman and the weird things that he tends to get up to. So at its simplest, this is just a movie about a couple, a man and a woman, going to visit his childhood home so that she can meet his parents for the first time. But because it's a Charlie Kaufman film, it is, of course, not that straightforward. So sometimes you have a trippy animated sequence involving like a cartoon pig or an ice cream mascot. Sometimes you have a 10-minute dance break. Even the dinner itself is very surreal. You see the parents get old and young and old again, and everyone's clothes keep changing. It gives the whole thing a very off-kilter, unsettling vibe. It almost feels like a horror movie, to the point where Toni Collette, who is in the movie, she plays a mom, might be even more disturbing here than she was in Hereditary. But for example, that dinner scene also turns out to be a really good way of expressing how it feels to meet a significant other's parents for the first time, where everyone's trying a bit too hard and laughing a bit too much and trying to pretend it's not awkward. And I think that that gets to what I have found Kaufman as a writer and director to be really good at, is literalizing the subjective experience of existence. You've seen it a lot in Synecdoche, New York, which is one of my favorite movies, where those things in the movie don't make literal sense, but overall it gives you an impression of what it's like for this man to live his life. But that said, I'm Thinking of Ending Things, like a lot of his movies, is also very dense and cryptic, and I think it's going to be frustrating to people who kind of want a clear explanation or an obvious solution. But to me, someone who likes that, that's kind of what's special about him. I think these movies really almost function like a Rorschach test, where there's so much going on in them that what you see in them says as much about you as about the movie. And to me, this ends up being a really thoughtful and touching movie about the porousness of identity. And then wrapped up in that are all these ideas about relationships and family and time and aging and gender and culture and what it means to try to be yourself in a world where all those things are inextricably linked with how you see yourself. So it might not be for everyone, but if you like Charlie Kaufman and his brand of weirdness, I loved it. I saw it twice. I liked it even more the second time.
Well, I'm with you, Angie. I'm on Charlie Kaufman's team. I'm really looking forward to seeing this. We're talking about the Netflix horror drama I'm Thinking of Ending Things. Tim?
Yeah. And for those people who want that neat, tied up little ending, well, then they're not aficionados of Charlie Kaufman
so
films.
True.
As are we. He's only done that once in his career. Believe it or not, it was in that first film, Being John Malkovich. It's the least interesting thing in the film when he tries to wrap it up at the end. He quit doing that. This is adapted from a 2016 Canadian horror novel, a horror novel. I don't know that book. But in terms of the way this story is being told, it's visual and temporal landscapes, people and places shifting about in time and perception. Obsession is a theme always in Charlie Kaufman films. There's an unreliable narrator. We always get that in a Charlie Kaufman film. Do we even know what the names of these characters are? You don't know. It's quintessentially a Charlie Kaufman film, plus one of the creepiest horror movies I've ever, ever seen. Well, this is what Charlie Kaufman does. He subverts expectations. So we come into this with expectations of what a Charlie Kaufman film will be. He subverts that by making a horror film. Then he makes a horror film unlike any other horror film you've ever seen, subverting all of the things that you expect to see in a horror film. This is what he does. What is it about? Hell if I know. That's just absolutely fine with me. Got no problem with that whatsoever. There's something in there to do with string theory, but then again, it might just be a horror film, man.
I'm Thinking of Ending Things from writer-director Charlie Kaufman. It's rated R and streaming on Netflix. We'll get started, at least, on the documentary Jimmy Carter, Rock and Roll President, the film directed by Mary Wharton. Tim?
Jimmy Carter was the first election in 1976. I wasn't old enough to vote for him then, but he was the first president I voted for in 1980 in a losing effort. But I had always been a fan of Jimmy Carter. This movie is ostensibly about his relationship to rock and roll, to music in general, not just rock and roll. The Allman Brothers Band, Johnny Cash, Muddy Waters, but Dizzy Gillespie, Herbie Hancock, they show up in this movie too. And how all of those people together helped in the effort in putting Jimmy Carter into the White House is the base through line of this movie. But you get that history, too. You just get that walk down memory lane. Jimmy Carter, that peanut farmer and nuclear physicist, first person in his family to go to college. How he grew up. Jimmy Carter grew up going to all black churches all the time. This film tells you a lot about who Jimmy Carter is as a person, and we walk right through all of that history. And Jimmy Carter's in the film, all 95 years of him. And it's just a fantastic walk through that history, and I loved it.
I love this film, too. Having actually visited Plains and where he grew up and spending some time there in that area of Georgia, and the music of this is just great. That great jazz concert at the White House. So much more. Jimmy Carter, Rock and Roll President. It's streaming on Lemley's Virtual Cinema starting next week.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting an evening in focus, Goya. The museum's galleries come to life at this interactive event, celebrating the opening of the exhibition, I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. Enjoy live music, art-making activities for all ages, live model drawing, tours, and more. Free with museum admission. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. More information at nortonsimon.org.
It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us with our critics Angie Hahn and Tim Cogshell. Next up is the French comedic drama Cuties. The film is written and directed by Maimouna Doukkerhe, and it's streaming on Netflix. Angie, what'd you think of Cuties?
I liked it quite a bit. It's quite a lovely coming-of-age drama about an 11-year-old Muslim girl named Ami, played by Fatou Youssef, who's just immigrated to Paris from Senegal and falls in with a clique of rebellious young dancers who call themselves the Cuties. And it reminds me a bit of like Celine Sciamma's Girlhood, which is also very deep into the thrills and politics of a girl gang, but these girls are younger, which makes it more playful in some ways and maybe not more alarming, but I guess differently alarming in others. And you may also remember that this movie stirred up a little bit of controversy a few weeks ago when the Netflix marketing began and people were criticizing it for making it look like the film was sexualizing its young female leads, which is ironic because it's actually pretty pointedly about the negative effects of the over-sexualization of young women. So Ami and her friends are tweens kind of trying to figure out how to become women by looking at the women and girls around them, in some cases teenagers not that much older than themselves, and reflecting those ideas of femininity and sexuality back out in the world and kind of experimenting with different ways of how to be. Like, there's one scene that encapsulates it really well where she is, where Ami is supposed to be praying, but she's hiding under her veil and watching twerking videos. And it's kind of a funny moment, but also I think gets to what the movie is very much about. So these scenes of self-objectification and self-sexualization are in the movie, but they're very deliberately, they're deliberately meant to be uncomfortable. You're watching these girls navigating self-image and sexuality in a world that keeps trying to tell them how other people want to be, but don't give them space to kind of figure it out themselves. And they're putting on these provocative moves without understanding exactly what they're doing. But what I liked about this film is there's such an honesty and boldness in the way that the writer-director covers this thorny topic, and I was impressed by how well she handles the nuances and complications of her journey, and also how well she understands how amazing and terrible it is to be a tween girl hanging out with other tween girls. It's not perfect, but I think for a directorial debut, it's really confident and interesting and has something worthwhile to say about coming of age.
We're talking about Cuties, French comedic drama from Mamouna Doucouré, and it's her feature writing and directing debut. The film will be streaming on Netflix starting next Wednesday. It's not available currently on Netflix, but the unrated film Cuties next Wednesday begins streaming on Netflix. The drama Critical Thinking is directed by John Leguizamo, who stars in the film. It's written by Dito Montiel. Tim?
Yeah. Set in Miami's Jackson community in 1998, it's about a dedicated teacher in a tough school in an even tougher neighborhood who strives to teach his kids chess and all the lessons that come with it. These are just some of my favorite movies, the heroic teacher movies. They're almost always based on true stories, as is this one. Even To Sir With Love is based on E.R. Brathwaite's work with East End kids and the East End of London after the war in the early 50s.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Absolutely is. Stand and Deliver, of course, the Jaime Escalante story. Lean on Me, Morgan Freeman walking around playing Principal Joe Clark with that baseball bat. Can't do that today. Dangerous Minds, Michelle Pfeiffer as Lou Ann Johnson, Freedom Riders. These are all of these movies. This one stars John Leguizamo as a teacher named Mario Martinez, who in 1998 had this chess class. His class was really just being as a place to park the bad kids. Instead of detention, they put the kids in his chess class, but he taught them how to play chess, and they got good. They got real good. But they lived in this neighborhood where you know, horrible things happen and kids get killed. And if there's anything that's perhaps a little irritating about this, is that class, you know, the real world was shaped with him and mostly boys. There were girls in his class, but they don't play a large part in this story or in this movie. And, you know, so that is what it actually is. And, you know, the dialogue, when it's sort of being churned out, can be a little bit heavy. But when John Leguizamo is doing that thing that he does, when he's just flowing with those kids and he's talking to them about chess and how it's played and what it actually means about life, well, this movie is as good as any of the rest of those other ones. I really enjoyed it.
Critical Thinking, directed by and starring John Leguizamo. It's unrated. You can see it on the Lemley's Virtual Cinema and on multiple on-demand platforms. Critical Thinking. Feels Good Man, a documentary about the character Pepe the Frog. It's directed by Arthur James. Angie?
I first saw this film at Sundance, and I think I've been telling people to watch it on and off since then, so that should give you an impression of how much I liked it. So it's a documentary about Pepe the Frog, like you said, the cartoon character that became a meme and a hate symbol and an agent of chaos and change. And it's got interviews with dozens of people, including Matt Fury, the creator, and his friends, but also 4chaners, academics, experts, lawyers, a Trump strategist, an occultist, some very odd fellow who collects rare Pepe memes. It's a whole thing. You'll have to watch the documentary to understand. And it combines that with archival images and clips from social media and news reports, and it's all held together with these animated interludes that really help to illustrate some of the feelings or abstract ideas being described in the interviews. And at its most basic level, it's just the history of Pepe, which traces his journey over the past decade or so. But the story of Pepe the Frog also turns out to be a story about meme culture and about going viral and about the rise of 4chan and the alt-right and the election of Donald Trump and the protests in Hong Kong. And if that sounds like a lot of stuff going on, it really is. And it's almost dizzying, except that the director has a really good handle on the story he's telling and never goes so far in one direction that he loses sight of the others. I was actually really impressed with how he managed to fold so much into this one movie. I mean, he has a lot of curiosity and open-mindedness, so you go down all these random corners, but he manages to bring it all together. It's honestly kind of a surprise to realize it's only 90 minutes long because it covers so much ground. But it's not so dense that it's difficult to follow. I found it to be really fascinating. It makes such a convincing case for Pepe, who's this ubiquitous cartoon frog that you've probably seen and kind of just rolled your eyes at or just laughed at and not thought much of, as this intersection of all these different threads in American life, or I guess not even just American life, just life how it is right now. And it gets at the purpose that memes serve in culture and how they don't just reflect the society we live in, but have the power to shape it. So I found this to be a really fascinating documentary and really well done.
Feels Good Man, unrated documentary. Tim?
Yeah, Arthur James, directing debut here, documentary directing debut, but he is a noted animator. And there's a whole lot of animation in this film about this cartoon done by him and other people. So the animation sort of supports what's going on. So in addition to that curiosity and asking all the interesting questions, he brings that skill too. Pepe originated in 2005. A young cartoonist, very young cartoonist named Matt Fury, created Pepe as a part of a group of characters for a comic book that he called Boys Club, and popped it on MySpace and Gaia and all of these places. And, you know, before we knew it, it was gone. And the thing about Pepe, his first iteration was as this extremely positive, wonderful character. Young girls adopted the meme of Pepe early on and used it for, you know, makeup sessions and all of this kind of stuff. And then, of course, we see the alt-right come in. And even before them, these sort of angry internet troll types came in, and they adopt Pepe. And we learn where that phrase "feels good, man" comes from, and then it goes off in the direction that it goes. Matt Fury is in this documentary a lot, and mostly what he is trying to do eventually is grab back the image and representation of Pepe, and bring it back to what he always intended it to be. He, for years, he just sort of lets it go, and then he decides that he can't do that anymore. And a good chunk of this documentary is about that too.
Feels Good Man is unrated. It's on multiple on-demand platforms. The documentary about the character Pepe the Frog, directed by Arthur James. The Spanish documentary The Andorra Hustle is directed by Eric Marola. Tim?
Yeah, Andorra. This is an absolutely fascinating thing. Andorra Hustle, it's a play on American Hustle, that narrative film, Christian Bale and all those folks. Interestingly, though, this documentary has more in common with another Christian Bale film, The Big Short, which is a narrative film about things that happen in the real world of American finance, laid out in this sort of thrilling narrative film. So this is a documentary that plays like a narrative film about things that happen in the real world of finance that destroyed a movement, the Catalan movement, that destroyed a bank, the BPA bank, and destroyed a number of people's lives. And the United States of America is right smack dab in the middle of all of it. And it's pretty straightforward. Several talking heads, most of them speaking Catalan, because Andorra, in Andorra, they speak Catalan. Andorra is a diarchy that's headed by two princes. One of them is the president of France, and the other one is the bishop of Urgel in Catalonia, Spain. That connection there is what's going on in this movie. And that in Section 31 of that was a part of the U.S. code that was used to take out this bank and to do all of these things. I found it absolutely intriguing and fascinating, even though I'm not a fan of this filmmaker, who's made some documentaries about some dubious subjects, the Brzezinski method and things like that, the God cell and things like that. This, though, is pretty straightforward in what it's talking about and how these things are connected. So to that end, I found it interesting.
Having visited Andorra just a couple of years ago, it's like a luxury ski resort turned into its own country. So fascinating place.
Absolutely, yeah.
The Andorra Hustle, the Spanish documentary from Eric Marola, is unrated, and it's on Amazon Prime Video. The Social Dilemma is a documentary directed by Jeff Orlowski, and it's streaming on Netflix. Angie?
It occurred to me as I was finishing this movie that this may be the one Netflix movie that no one watches while absentmindedly scrolling on their phone, because if you watch it for more than a few minutes, you start to feel really weird about the fact that you are often absentmindedly scrolling on your phone. this is a documentary about what the subjects in it call the problem beneath the problem, which is the ways that social media is fundamentally designed to overcome human weakness and manipulate our behavior for the benefit of advertisers and big social media companies. And the film traces this to everything from political polarization to the rising rates of suicide and self-harm among teens. And I saw this documentary at Sundance, and I noticed that the final version on Netflix also makes it more timely by adding in stuff about the coronavirus and the way that disinformation and this inability to agree on objective truth and reality has really impacted us, and not for the better. And I think the most impressive thing about this documentary is probably its collection of talking heads, because it's not just the usual, you know, academics and experts and stuff like that, but it's a lot of this, it actually, there's interviews with a lot of the people who created this problem to begin with, like people who were high up in Facebook or Twitter, Instagram, Google, Pinterest, stuff like that. The guy that designed the Facebook like button, the guy that figured out how to monetize Facebook, the guy that figured out that, you know, how YouTube recommendations should work. And so when these people tell you that social media and the way that it is a problem, you tend to really believe them. So that part of it is really effective. It's a little bit all over the place because it's covering so much ground, but I think that most people will leave this with a lot of things to talk about and hopefully, you know, trying to change some things. But less effective is that it's also interwoven with this kind of fictional narrative about a boy that has a smartphone and uses social media too much and it ruins his life or whatever. And that part of it can be interesting for visual aids because, you know, you have all these talking heads telling you about these things, so it's useful to see how it works. And, you know, there's this Vincent Kartheiser from Mad Men plays an algorithm, so when these people are talking about algorithms but you see a person playing the algorithm show you how it works, you're like, oh, okay, I get it. But the part with the boy it has that like really painfully generic kind of tone of like those PSAs you watch in high school that's just like, oh, this like, you know, straight A student smoked weed once and now they're dead in an alleyway. So it almost kind of undermines, I think, the urgency because it makes it seem so almost a little bit alarmist, which is a shame. But I think still, even despite that, it overall works really well. It certainly has a lot of salient points to make, and I think we'll really leave you thinking twice about whether you want to immediately pick up your phone and check Twitter after you watch this movie.
The Social Dilemma, Netflix documentary with some narrative creation. Tim?
Yeah, documentary with some narrative. No, look, at the full-on narrative drama smack dab in the middle of this movie. It's what it is, talking heads, figures from the real worlds of Silicon Valley, some of the creators, the guy who co-created the like button. I didn't even know that was a thing you could do, but it is, and it made a big, big difference in the way the world works right now. Social theorists, and then these actors playing these characters in this drama, sort of a thriller, really, that sort of represent the things that the documentary part of the film is revealing and explaining. It's captivating, it absolutely is, it's entertaining, certainly. But from a cinematic standpoint, documentary? No, I don't think so. I think we need a new word for these movies. But, you know, that notwithstanding, basically the gist of this is that social media, particularly the biggies, are spying on you, manipulating you, whether you think it or not, and making you a more biased person, whether you whether you think so or not. What Angie was talking about, the big splits in society, what this film says is that's all on purpose. People are being put into silos in a very particular way that's being manipulated by very smart people and extremely powerful computers and social scientists and everything else. Tim Kendall, the former president of Pinterest and the former director of monetization, a very, very important thought here, says the natural conclusion of all of this is civil war. Now, is that hyperbolic? I don't know. Maybe. But if you watch this movie, you're going to think, maybe not. Maybe not.
The Social Dilemma, a docudrama, for lack of a better term, on Netflix from director Jeff Orlowski. Also want to just quickly mention some recommendations. Harley Quinn, the adult animated series based on supervillain Harley Quinn. Angie, that real quickly, your recommendation on that?
Yeah, so I started watching it. It's originally from DC Universe, but now it's available on HBO Max. And I do think that you will know within the first half hour or so whether its sense of humor is going to be for you, because it's very wacky, very silly. I think it does a really good job of kind of poking fun at a lot of DC Comics tropes, but in a very affectionate way, okay. A little bit like Lego Batman, but, you know, much more grown up. So if you like that sense of humor right away, then stick with it because it just gets better as it goes on.
All right. We're talking about Harley Quinn, which is on HBO Max, part of the DC Universe. I do want to remember Chadwick Boseman, who we lost just about a week ago to colon cancer, an actor with so many iconic performances. Angie, your memories of Boseman's work?
Oh, I was so shocked when I heard the news. I mean, obviously, looking around, everyone was. And he's someone that I was most familiar with, probably like a lot of people, from the Marvel movies. And I remember even even in Civil War, where he plays the supporting role, like obviously he's great in Black Panther, but Civil War is the first time you meet this character, and immediately you see kind of what makes Chadwick Boseman so special, and also probably one of the reasons he's played so many kind of iconic larger-than-life figures is that he has a way of bringing this gravitas to the role where you understand that this is someone you have to sit up and pay attention to, like, you know, him as an actor, but also him as a character. And, you know, it's someone that has an outsized influence on the world around him and that a lot of people pay attention to. But you also get to see a lot of this humanity and warmth to him.
Yeah.
So I think that he kind of brings those sides of his characters together really well. Like, I thought Jackie Robinson... Or I saw 42 right after, and he brings a lot of that there too.
Such a talented performer. If you want to hear what Tim Gokshel has to say, Tim joined me on Monday's Air Talk to Remember Chadwick Boseman. You can find our conversation at kpecc.org. Much more to come on Film Week in just a minute. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC and the KPECC app. I'm Larry Mantle. Christopher Nolan's new time travel thriller, Tenet, released this week after several delays due to the coronavirus pandemic. But if you live here in Southern California, you won't be able to see it in a local theater. The film isn't available on demand. It's only screening in cities where indoor theaters have reopened. One way you could see it is to make the drive to Las Vegas, where some theaters have reopened. KPCC's John Horn did just that and tells us what it's like to go to the movies in the era of COVID-19.
All I have for you is a word.
Christopher Nolan's new movie was supposed to come out on July 17th, then July 31st, then August 12th. Finally, Tenet arrives this weekend.
Use it carefully.
Now, if you really wanted to see the movie before Friday, you could. But because California theaters are still closed, you had to hit the road and find a city where theaters were hosting sneak previews for Tenet earlier this week. So I rented a muscle car, put on an audiobook, and started driving.
Viva Las Vegas! Viva Las Vegas!
Yes, Las Vegas, just 260 miles away, made the most sense. I drove up Interstate 15 to the Century 16 South Point, just a little bit south of the Las Vegas airport, where Tenet was playing on five screens. The theater is owned by the national chain Cinemark, the nation's third largest, and for the past 5 months, almost all of its U.S. theaters have been padlocked by the pandemic. In its most recent quarter, Cinemark had just a few $1,000s in ticket sales, compared to more than $500 million in the same quarter a year ago. To find out more about the safety protocols Cinemark would have in its theaters, and whether they were confident people would actually come back when they opened, I called up Chanda Brashears. She's Cinemark's Vice President for Investor Relations and Corporate Communications.
Listen, I, along with my family, I've got children, have enjoyed watching movies at home. We always have. But there is something about the experience. It's the enhanced sight and sound technology. It's the darkened movie theater auditorium. It's this shared social experience.
Brashears added that some Cinemark theaters already have been open for a couple of months and that the chain is confident in its safety standards.
We wanted an opportunity to test the training, communication, and implementation of those standards. And so we've had test and learn theaters open. And, you know, that started with five in early June. I guess it would be mid-June. And really expanded from there. We've got 220 theaters open currently. That's about 70% of our circuit.
Like so many things in Las Vegas, you have to walk through a casino to get to the theaters at the Century 16 South Point. Then you take an escalator up a floor from the slot machines to the box office. And as you go up, you leave behind the casino's stale odor of cigarette smoke and desperation and start to smell buttered movie popcorn. Our sense of smell can be the most personally nostalgic, bringing back a flood of memories, and that's exactly what happened to me. I was back, both physically and, in a way, emotionally, at a movie theater. but a lot had changed in the 5 months I'd been away. Like most national chains, Cinemark has implemented an array of new pandemic protocols. When I booked my seat online, the theater's website automatically blocked off several seats next to me. And you don't get a physical ticket. It's a barcode on your mobile phone. All around the lobby were signs of what the theater was doing to keep people safe and what customers needed to do, like wearing masks and maintaining social distancing. The concession stand offered no refills, no shared soda machines, or condiment stations. You had to pay by credit card, no cash accepted. And inside the auditorium, theater staff were sanitizing seats and handrails between every screening. There were wipes everywhere, and rather than a theater having an usher, Cinemark has what it calls chief clean and safety monitors. They're charged with making sure that people inside are following the new rules. While it's certainly safer to stay at home and watch Netflix, this didn't feel dangerous, and the moviegoers I talked to going in to see Tenet agreed.
With the guidelines that have been put in place, the protocols, I've heard positive things the last couple of weeks from people in town. So, I'm about ready to experience it and see what it's about.
I didn't really feel that much different. I mean, people are a little more spaced apart, which doesn't bother me. Other than that, it's about the same.
I think it's an acceptable risk. I'm a big Chris Nolan fan. Memento was captivating from the beginning, and I just love good movies.
It was touted as being the movie to bring back theaters, so I figured why not go and go the first night that it's available. And you never feel safe, of course, but I feel like this is one thing I'm willing to risk.
Inside the auditorium, the nearest person to me was seven seats away, and I watched him carefully as he took off and then put his mask back on between bites of popcorn. Pretty soon, I relaxed in my recliner seat and disappeared into the movie, which is really, really good. So will I go back? Not to Las Vegas, that won't happen anytime soon, but a movie theater really depends. Part of my job at KPCC is covering movies, and some films, like Tenet, you can't see anywhere else but in a theater. But will I risk the multiplex to see the upcoming Candyman remake or a new movie about Clifford the Big Red Dog? As my older son would say, that's a hard no. For Film Week, I'm John Horn, leaving Las Vegas.
Viva, viva Las Vegas!
Thanks to John for making the trek to Las Vegas to see the film and share his experience. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up, John's interview with Tenet star John David Washington. We'll be back.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting an evening in focus, Goya. The museum's galleries come to life at this interactive event, celebrating the opening of the exhibition, I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. Enjoy live music, art-making activities for all ages, live model drawing, tours, and more. Free with museum admission. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. More information at nortonsimon.org.
In a minute. So good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about the new Christopher Nolan film, Tenet, which opens in theaters this weekend, but only where theaters are open, and that doesn't include Southern California. We turn from John Horn talking about what it was like to see it in a Vegas theater to talking with the film star John David Washington. John Horn asked him what it was like as an actor to have a movie ready for release, but then stuck on the shelf due to the coronavirus.
Well, it helped me manage my expectations. You know, if it were gonna go to streaming, then I just wanted people to see it. And I could tell you this, I feel a great deal of relief now that knowing that it's going to be released as it should be. I think this film deserves to be on the big screen and needs to be experienced in a theater, an IMAX theater preferably. And as long as everybody's being safe about it, I'm very excited about people going. I commend and I respect and want to shout out Warner Brothers for supporting Christopher Nolan and them, you know, putting a game plan together, working with the AMCs, all the theaters around the globe, to ensure this people's safety and to be able to experience this film the way it should be experienced.
One way that Christopher Nolan shoots for like a ship, he rolls the camera backwards. So the the path of something like a ship is reversed. But for an actor, that doesn't always work because it looks wrong. So are you trying to train your body to, especially like in fight scenes, to go backward?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I literally had to learn how to walk downstairs, which would be upstairs, and walking up the stairs in inverted time. So I had to learn how to walk backwards. I had to learn how to fight backwards, block punch backwards, punch backwards, get thrown and throw backwards. Like I said, blink backwards, be able to aim and shoot a gun backwards. It was unlike anything I've ever experienced before. And I was pretty confident in my athletic ability, being that I've had a football background. But in football, you're always trying to advance the ball forward. So that was, you know, just having to retrain or train my mind into these rules took some time. But we were able to get it done.
Christopher Nolan likes to say that on every movie, he challenges himself as a filmmaker. How did he challenge you as an actor?
Interesting. I like that question. He challenged me as an actor in a way you wouldn't suspect. He challenged me to believe in myself, to trust my instincts, especially with a concept like this, the position he put me in a film like this. He knew I could do it. He totally trusted me and welcomed my ideas and my approach to it. He told me not to abandon that. And, you know, he literally had told me, "We'll adjust to you at some point." A couple of times he told me that. So when the legendary Christopher Nolan says, "Don't worry, we'll adjust to you," you know, just that's a heavy, that's heavy to take. That's unbelievable that he believes in me that much. Somebody like this who's accomplished so much. So that kind of confidence he instilled in me, the same way Spike Lee did, I'll take with me forever and moving forward as I grow into the artistry.
There's not a lot of exposition about where your character has been before, and that's not at all a spoiler. But as an actor, you probably need to know how the protagonist got to be where he is, how he knows as much as he does. So even if it's not in the script, how did you create the inner life of that character? And what were the conversations you had with Christopher Nolan or other people about how your character got where he is? Because we don't really know, and Christopher isn't that interested in explaining it. But as an actor, you kind of need to know.
Yeah, no, I love that he's not interested in explaining it. I think we talked about it, Chris and I, and I was able to pull resources from different people. You know, I talked to some Navy SEALs. I talked to, you know, people that are in the spy business, if you will. And I was able to pull these resources and gather some background information. But really what was happening in combination with that was the training. I usually work inside out and do all my research first, then I can inform how I walk or talk or whatever, but getting sort of just jolted right into the training early and first started to inform the kind of person that he is, the decisions he makes, what charges all of his decision-making and how he reacts to things, how he assesses things, his perception of the world. That was pretty cool. That was a new way of doing things for me as far as an actor. And that was also, this through this character, was my way into understanding the entire concept of this film, which obviously took some time. So it was an unconventional way. I wasn't used to doing it that way, and I think it worked for the character. I'm glad it happened this way. I wouldn't have changed a thing in preparation. But you know, I just wanted to bring the humanity into the character. You know, when a lot of these films, this kind of a genre, you know, it could be convenient to fall into a certain way of doing things. And credit to Christopher Nolan for being open to making him human and putting a human being thrown into a world like this. I think some of his insecurities and his vulnerabilities are his strength. I think the fact that he cares so much about people, he cares so much about the people he's fighting along with, even more than the mission, is a strength. I think it's a power. It's not a weakness, and that could separate him from other agents.
There's a character in the film who says to your character, "Don't try to understand it, feel it," which seems like it's a great line, but does that apply actually to how you like to act? Do you need to understand it? Do you want to know what the math is, or are you just going to say, "I'm along for the ride, and my character's curious, so I'm going to play curious"?
No, I would love if I can get to that one day, then yeah, that would probably be the way to go. But no, I tried. I go to great detail, to great lengths to try to get the understanding of it. It's my job to. That being said, I can't let that overwhelm the feelings. I can't let that prohibit, you know, any or I should say enable the possibilities, because that's what I live for. What's possible? What can we find on the day? So a lot of times with everything I've prepared for, you come in you come into the set, you rehearse it, it goes exactly how you think, and then all of a sudden, maybe around take three or four, something shifts, something happens that is more truthful in the moment. Then I go with that instinct, and that can become a feeling and not an understanding. But I understand that it's the preparation that led me there. I have to earn that kind of spontaneity. I have to earn the ability I have to earn the moments of being able to feel something happen and just go with that, based off of the preparation that I put in, the research that I've done.
When you think back to the most challenging scenes in this film, were they challenging in a physical way, challenging in an emotional or kind of psychic way? How would you describe the toughest days for you on this shoot?
Well, there were several, and everything you just mentioned, in all facets. There were some days that were emotionally, they just took it out of me. There was I was just giving so much, you know, that day, and the moment required it. And again, some of those emotional days I had, there were some emotional scenes I felt like that were in there that you usually don't see in genres like this. And when you see the final product, you know, you do the take, but you never know what the director wants or is going to use. And I was surprised that he used some of the stuff that we did. And those are some tough days, along with the heights thing. I'm not really good with heights, and being on the tallest building in Mumbai, jumping off a balcony, I'd say that was probably the hardest day for me, and probably took the longest to shoot. So I thank God for the patience.
How do you think this movie changed you as an actor? How did you come out of it a different performer?
You know, I got to, because of the great Christopher Nolan, he taught me about film and the process of it, and how to see film, how he loves it. I came out a person that better appreciates the process and everybody's different process. And I appreciated the love I have, even more love I have for the business, for working in the film industry. Because this man who's accomplished everything still loves it like a kid. Spike Lee was the same way. Still loves it like he's a little kid, like this is his first film. So what does that mean to me? It means that eliminate the ego. You know, it's we're here to serve. We're here to serve the project. You know, so put that aside. It's a deterrent, you know, and I love that about them, because I feel the same way. I love what I do, and I'm still new at this. So those guys, they feel like they have the same energy too. They just were so energetic. They can just keep going and shoot all day. You know, I loved it.
That's John David Washington, the star of the new movie Tenet, talking with our John Horn. You can find John's podcast, Hollywood the Sequel, at laist.com/podcasts. That, along with the full slate of podcasts from LAIST Studios and KPCC. Once again, that's laist.com/podcasts. And we remind you that Film Week itself is available as a podcast to take with you wherever and whenever you want. Have a wonderful weekend.